I'm Brittany French.
Hey, I'm Rob McDonald.
And this is the Great Plains Outdoors Podcast.
We're going to talk about everything from fishing and hunting to hiking, paddling, and adventures on the Great Plains. We'll cover it all here.
So join us each episode and hear what's going on in the great outdoors on the Great Plains. Welcome to another episode of the Great Plains Outdoors Podcast. We are kicking off the month of March with some yet again questionable weather, only making me long for the spring turkey season. I don't know about you guys, but I'm super stoked for some consistent spring weather. We're gearing up for another heavy fundraising season with Outdoor Mentors. So if you're looking to support a nonprofit, give our website a look at outdoormentors.org. We've got lots of raffles and events coming up that anyone can partake in. We'd love to have you there. Rob, what's new in your world?
Hey, Brittany, you know, it has sort of been a whirlwind, you know, all these hunting seasons closed and kind of got everything cleaned up and decoys put away and all that type of stuff. But I did get out last weekend and did a little trout fishing on the Great Plains. My youngest son actually got a fly rod for Christmas. And so he was, and he's eight. So he was really itching to get out and try it. You know, we've had ice pretty well off and on since Christmas and no opportunity. And so we went and hit a little spot where Kansas Department of Wildlife and Parks does their winter stocking trout program, their put and take trout program. And I would encourage any listeners out there, if you're looking for something to do on a spring afternoon, go give it a try. It's a lot of fun. And my boys figured it out. We had a blast. And we brought home a few trout that I'm going to put in a smoker. And so I'm excited about that.
Yum. That sounds great. I'm glad you mentioned looking up different areas that your department or your state agency might be stocking. I think so many people don't realize that that happens. And it's a good way to get out there and increase your chances of catching some fish.
You bet.
Yeah. So speaking of some outdoor adventures, I'm so glad you got out on some with your kiddos yet again. Rob is killing parenthood over here in the outdoors. People need to take notes and he needs to write a book, apparently. It's pretty great. But we've got a really special guest on the podcast today, a guest I've had the privilege to work with professionally. Now I call him my friend. Hopefully Joe does too. Joe Dickey is an award-winning photographer and videographer who specializes in hunting and farm and ranch conservation stories, really capturing all kinds of outdoor adventures and stories on film. It's pretty incredible if you've not seen any of his work yet. He attended college at the University of Minnesota, graduating with a fine arts degree. He had added a design degree later and spent 10 years as a creative director before pursuing his true passion, photography and videography. In 2013, Joe began focusing on sustainable and regenerative agricultural stories for a number of clients. That's a mouthful, Joe.
It is. Yeah.
A few years later, he found his way into the hunting industry, capturing stories for clients like Savage Arms, which we love, and Federal Cartridge. Joe's corporate client list includes Vista Outdoors, the Food Network, Cargill, Nike, Walmart, PGA Tour, one of my favorites, and Pepsi and General Mills.
Welcome to the podcast, Joe. You know, I'm excited just to get to hang out with you.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
One of the coolest dudes out there, let me tell you.
Oh, man, I'm blushing.
Well, Joe, tell us about yourself. Give us the elevator pitch of who Joe Dickey is.
Oh, man. So you kind of went through a little bit of my background as far as being a designer, creative director. If you go way back, I was really inspired by my great grandmother and great aunt who were amateur photographers, but had such great vision and captured just amazing photos. They were running Brownie cameras back when I was a little kid, and we were up at the cabin in the resort, and they were always capturing photos, not staged photos, but just real photojournalism style photos of life, you know, up at the cabin and the family. And we had slideshows in the great room at the resort every couple of weeks up there. So I grew up looking at their images, and you know, I think it really inspired me to do what I do. And you know, life often takes you in a lot of different directions. So I did a lot of things, anything from, you know, I was a DJ for 20 years and worked as, you know, as a designer, and but I never gave up on that love of photography. When my oldest was a year old, I started doing photos of her, and then I started doing photos for family and friends. And next thing I knew, I had this little business doing family photos that worked into wedding photography, which I think really gave me my chops for capturing stories. I think if you can photograph a wedding, you can kind of handle any situation, any stress. Brittany, you're, how long have you been married now? I feel like it was just yesterday, but I bet it's been a couple of years, right?
You know, this is funny. Yeah. Somebody asked us that last night and I jokingly looked at Ben. I'm like, how long have we been married? He's like 17 months. And I'm like, what?
Good for him. He's got it down.
I was like, when did that happen?
Yeah. Wow. So as you know, that's a pretty serious undertaking to be a photographer or a videographer at a wedding, because you only have one shot at it. So I did that for a number of years, and it got to the point, I shot 65 weddings in 2007, which was just crazy. That's four weddings on Labor Day weekend, you know.
How many bridezillas in that kind of?
You know, honestly, I was pretty lucky. I think my style really attracted people that were a little bit more laid back, and so I really didn't have too many stories. If I had any, I probably shouldn't share them. But for the most part, I really had some great brides and grooms that I worked with and families. And really, it was wedding photography that led me into commercial photography through a bride. I got into General Mills through a bride who worked for an agency here in the Twin Cities. And then I also got into my farm and ranch stories through another bride in South Dakota. And she connected me with the NRCS of South Dakota. And so that's how I kind of went in two different directions. It's funny, the older you get, you look back on life and you say, how did I end up where I'm at? You know, and a lot of people hear my story. I've, you know, spoken in front of groups of videographers and photographers, and they hear my story and they're like, well, how did you get where you're at? I understand your story, but it seems like you just got lucky. And I think life is a little bit about that. You call it what you want. I call it faith, you know, but you know, God sends you in the right direction. Right. And so yeah. I've been really fortunate to get into the things that I'm doing now. And you know, so that, you know, that's kind of how I end. And if I go back to when I was, designer, creative director, I worked for a company called North American Outdoors. There was a number of affinity clubs that we had. In other words, we made our money through club memberships. We had magazines that we published, and then we sold products to the club members. Clubs ranging from the PGA Tour Partners Club to North American Hunter and North American Fisherman, Cooking Pleasures. So I was on the advertising side of that. So I designed and developed websites and created email campaigns, and also did a lot of print work. And so I was around a lot of people, especially through North American Hunter, that had a passion for hunting. And then North American Fishermen fishing as well. And the two seem to go hand in hand. I mean, in the off season, if you're, you know, not carrying a shotgun, you've got a fishing pole in your hand. Mm-hmm. So it was a perfect place for me to be, because I grew up hunting and fishing with my family. So I made a lot of really good friends there. North American Outdoors kind of went under, not just kind of, they did. They were bought by a few different companies, and eventually it just sort of lost their way. So a lot of the people that worked there went in different directions. Some of my friends went to Vista Outdoors, Federal Cartridge, and they bring their friends with them. So, you know, they're working in the creative department, they need a photographer or videographer, they call their friends from North American Outdoors. So that's how I got into Federal Cartridge. And Vista used to own Savage. So when Beth went from working for Vista off on her own with Savage, still in the Twin Cities, she brought me with her. So that's how I got into the hunts with Savage. And don't tell her, but I think she thought that I had filmed hunts before. So, you know, I'm trying to remember what the first hunt I did, but you know, you sort of fake it till you make it. I mean, I'm a hunter, so it made sense for me to be able to do this stuff. But there's a lot more to filming a hunt than just going out and grabbing your camera and going out and doing it. And you learn a lot along the way. So anyway, that's sort of the backstory. And I'll stop there. I know you guys have questions.
No, thanks for sharing all that, Joe. And it just makes me go back to the point you made of like mentioning, is it luck or is it, you know, fate? Maybe it's both, but both of those things, you worked really hard to get to where you are.
Yeah.
And a lot of it is like taking that gamble. Like you said, 60 some weddings in a year. Well, that puts you kind of on the map to get in touch with all these other people. So good on you for putting in the hard work to get to where you are. It's well deserved.
Yeah. Thank you.
Joe,
go ahead, Rob.
Well, I'm curious. So, put a timeline to it. And I work in photography myself and aspire to do a little videography. I just kind of dabble in that a little bit, but thinking about the timeline of the generation of equipment, right? I remember the days of, it's going to date me, but I remember the days of taking 35 millimeter film in the dark room and unwinding it and winding it on to a developing reel and that kind of stuff. And then, you know, we moved from these big cameras that had like giant batteries and, you know, and now guys are using mirrorless DSLR and, you know, so what did that look like as far as how you move from, you know, wedding photography is one thing, you know, you show up with your sedan or your van or whatever you're geared up and you set up and you photograph the event. But that shift to walking across a prairie or a mountain, or, you know, what does that look like and how did that develop with, I guess, both you and your career and the equipment?
Yeah. Yeah. It's fun to talk with somebody that has actually been around long enough to remember film. Right. So, I talked about my great grandma using a Brownie camera. When I first started making money in photography, I was using a Yashica Mat 124G twin lens reflex camera, which is a real mouthful, but basically it's a top view camera. And when you move the camera, everything's reversed. So try chasing kids with a camera like that and, you know, trying to get everything exposed right. And as a art director, I worked through that transition from film to digital in a different way than I think most, because the first digital camera, there was one in the Twin Cities. And I want to say it was, at the time, I don't know, $100,000+ for this studio to get this camera. And actually, I take that back. That was the second digital iteration. The first one was a 3-pop camera, and it had this wheel that turned that shot through red, green, and blue. So it had to take 3 different plates and certain plates. That's a term that's not used in digital, but took 3 shots, meshed them together. And that's how you created the digital image. So we couldn't put people in the shots. There couldn't be any movement. It was just product and it looked terrible, you know? And then you get this really expensive single shot digital camera and it still looked really flat. So we were still leaning on film for our main shots, you know? So for North American Hunter, if we were trying to do a beauty shot and it was the big print shot, we always use film and then we just use digital for the insets. And you look back on that process and you're like, how did people have the faith that it was, that they were gonna spend that kind of money knowing that, you know, it still wasn't up to par, but at some point it was gonna get there. So we needed to jump on board. And I think that the people that embraced that and suffered through that transition from the get-go were the people that became the most successful. It was the risk takers, right? And I found the same thing being a still photographer and moving into video. The Canon came out with the 5D Mark II, Rob, and I know you remember that, right? It was like revolutionary. It was shooting HD video out of a DSLR camera. And some of the films that were made with that camera were just stunning. I shot my first television commercial on a manual focus 5D Mark II camera. I went over to South Africa for General Mills Fruit Snacks, they teamed up with One Laptop Per Child, and it was a get one, give one campaign. So if someone earned a laptop by collecting, I don't know if it was box tops from General Mills Fruit Snacks, if they earned a laptop, somebody in Africa was going to get a laptop. So we went over there, we delivered laptops, and I was hired to just shoot stills, but I had this fancy new 5D Mark II, and I was all fired up. Like, I had a slider. I invested some money in some equipment that would allow me to capture video. So I shot video on my own. And when we got back home, they looked at the footage and they're like, yeah, we love this. And they created a television commercial out of it. And a year and a half later, they sent me to Rwanda with the same camera, with an art director from Saatchi & Saatchi out of New York. And this was like their General Mills investment in being scrappy. So I think, you know, they may have spent, I don't know, $150,000 or $200,000 on that commercial, that it, because there was only a couple of us going over there, rather than their typical $500,000 plus on a television commercial. Right. And we shot this commercial on a 5D Mark II. So, you know, it's amazing that, you know, early on that kind of a camera was able to do what it needed to do to give us something that was different, you know, and it was just a different look. And I found that there was a lot of photographers that just weren't willing to make that jump. They weren't going to move from photo to video. They didn't see that at some point it was going to almost be necessary to make a living. You know, it's harder to make a living as a photographer now, you know, from a marketing standpoint, everybody needs video content. So, if you didn't jump on that train early on, you're scrambling to catch up still. And it's been, you know, it's been 14 years since that camera came out.
Yeah.
You know? So I don't know if I answered your question.
That's fantastic.
Kind of go off.
Mm-hmm. No, you know, I'm curious, in that story, was that a single camera body? I mean, did you have two or three of those in your backpack with a handful of batteries and three or four lenses, or did you just have like this one camera body that nobody, you know, TSA better take care of it? Cause
no, I had two camera bodies, and, you know, multiple lenses, obviously you know, being a wedding photographer, I always had to have two. Sure. I shot two at a time. I always shot with a 24 millimeter prime mm-hmm. on one camera and 85-1.2 on the other camera. And so, I was always running two camera bodies, and interestingly enough, $40,000 in equipment was lost on the way home from when I was in Rwanda. Mm-hmm. It was a kind of a long story, but General Mills and American Express Travel got involved, and a couple months later it showed up, but we kind of knew that it was going to disappear. We had a suspicion about when we were dropping it off at baggage claim in Africa that somebody was going to steal it. But Anyway, two bodies.
Gotcha. That's wild. It's so interesting to hear you talk about shooting commercials and things like that, because I don't know that side of you as well as I know the filmed hunting guru that I know, you know. And that's my next question for you, Joe, is what is it like to be on the other side of the camera for these hunting trips, adventures? Sometimes you're out there for like a week at a time, if not longer. And what's that look like for you?
You know, obviously, like I said, I grew up hunting. I didn't do a ton of big game hunting, but we did deer hunting. We had deer camp in northern Minnesota. So I've always been in love with the hunt. And I think what I'm finding is I almost enjoy filming more than the hunt itself. And when I say that, I guess I shouldn't say it, because I am hunting. You know, when you're in a group, and you've done this, right? When you're with someone, even if it's just you and somebody that you're mentoring, you are as involved in that hunt as they are, as the person carrying the gun. It's a team effort. And you all have to be as stealth as, you know, one has to be as stealth as the other. And when you're running a camera or two cameras, I'm always running two cameras, because you have to get the shot facing the shooter, and you have to get whatever it is that you're hunting on camera. So, and you have to be a kind of above, right? I mean, if you're doing a stalk and you're sneaking and you're crawling and you're in grass, the camera can't see. So you have to somehow get up high enough and not tip the animal off. And I'm absolutely having a blast with it. It's mentally and physically challenging, way more so than if I was just doing the hunt, you know?
Yeah. You're so much energy. It's like, in being in a blind where you're filming a hunt, it's so contagious. And I have to tell a quick story about the last time Joe and I were in a blind during the youth deer season here in Kansas. And he was filming for Savage Arms. And we had exhausted this poor youth hunter. She was so sweet and was a trooper, but we gone out like four different sits. And so we're on the last, I think it's a morning sit, if I recall right. But yeah. Reagan is her name. And she's, you know, getting wore out, getting a little discouraged, as, you know, most youth hunters would be after so many sits. And finally this, you know, nice looking buck came out, still in velvet, and he was gorgeous, but he kind of like showed up and then spooked off behind some brush. And we were in a really cool situation where our blind was elevated. Out in front of us was a soybean field. And then to the left, it was kind of like going down into a creek. And then up top was like a hay field. And I, for the life of me, could not see this deer come out of the brush. So I'm looking and Joe's like, dude, it's right there. I'm like, what are you talking about? And Reagan's now like, can I shoot it? I'm like, what are you shooting at? What are you talking about? But I was just positioned far enough behind Reagan, I couldn't see this deer, and it was just right there in front of us for like, what, a good 30 seconds probably. Yeah. Oh, it's painful. It was so painful.
But, you know, in your defense, we were in a blind that, you know, even two people, it's kind of tight. And yes. Even if you're in a blind, as you know, like, you still have to be careful, especially when they're close, right? And this buck was pretty close, right? Yeah. So when you have, and when I'm filming, you have to kind of have it opened up a little bit more. So you have to be really careful about your movement in that blind. So you were kind of handcuffed. You were not in a position to be able to see it. So, and this is always the challenge of filming a hunt, is somebody's always waiting on somebody else, right? Yeah. Most of the time they're waiting on me. They're like, all right, you know, we're X amount of yards away from whatever it is we're hunting. And I'm trying to get the long lens on it because I've turned around to get the camera on the shooter. And then I turn back and you kind of lose sight of it. Right. So, it's not as easy as it sounds. And mentoring is the same way. I mean, you have to be on the same page, and it's really important that you are the one that helps make that call, because they're new and it's like, do you take the shot or not? And often it's an ethical reason, right? You know, mm-hmm. No, it's turned the wrong way, or there's brush in the way. So I'm just helping you out here. It was definitely not your fault. And the great thing is that she ended up getting that buck. It just took us a little bit longer. And we thought that it was gone, right? I think it ran off, and then we were like, oh, bummer. But then it came back.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was so good. I just remember Reagan being like, are you going to let me shoot this thing or not? And I'm like, oh, what are you talking about? And I was like, oh, God.
Thank goodness she was a new hunter, because if she'd been at it for a long time, she probably would have been like, oh, man, I had it, you know, right? Yep. But she's like so sweet about it. She's like, oh, you know, it's all good.
Yeah, she was so great. She was so great. It just makes me chuckle every time I think of that hunt. That's the same hunt we had that armadillo show up and you freaked out about it. You got all excited about it.
We don't have a lot of armadillos here. In fact, we don't have any. So I thought armadillos were only in Texas, you know? So here we are in Kansas and this armadillo comes out. And, yeah.
But Joe, I'm curious, over your career, I mean, you've been involved in all these facets and destinations and different companies. What's the most beautiful, I don't know if I want to say picturesque, because that can mean different things to different people, but in your mind, I mean, it could be a sea of prairie grass or, you know, an ocean vista, mountaintops. What's the most beautiful place that, you know, if you look back on your career that you're like, man, you know, that was the spot.
Yeah. Well, I hope you don't mind if I share a couple, because they're different.
Sure.
When I went over to Africa, for those two shoots, if you've been to Africa, it's just, you know, I think you grow up seeing footage of wild animals in Africa. It is absolutely amazing to be standing next to a giraffe, you know, in the wild or something like that. And we actually went up, hiked, and it was one of the toughest hikes I've ever done. We hiked up along the Congo border with the mountain gorillas. And that was something that I'll never forget. I mean, you know, coming upon a, I don't know what you call them, but a group of mountain gorillas, and the silverback is hiding in the brush. And the guide says, you know, if he comes running out and grabs you, go limp and let him throw you around and it'll all be good. Right. And he comes running out, thumping and making this noise. And I don't think I've ever been as scared in my life, but he just came out and had to show that he was dominant. And then he just laid down with everybody else. So that was pretty cool. But, you know, with these hunts, we get into some of the most gorgeous terrain ever, whether it's Montana or Wyoming. I was just filming a hunt in Idaho in knee deep snow a few weeks ago, and just absolutely gorgeous. So a lot of settings like that. But for me, the most amazing scene that I've ever been a part of was a ranch in South Dakota, probably 35,000 acre ranch that had buffaloes and buffalo, and they had 1,500 head of buffalo. We went out there in the dark because I wanted to film sunrise, and we rode out in a truck, and my son, who is 22, which I'll share a little bit. And he's in school for film and media, and he's been part of my shoots for 10, 12 years. So I get to share these experiences with him, but he was in the cab of the truck. I was up on top, and they had this bin that was filled with these pellets. And I can't for the life of me remember exactly what, basically it's some kind of nutrition that they feed to supplement.
Yeah, a cake feeder with range cubes on it. Yeah.
So I was up on top of the cake feeder, sitting in the cake, filming so I could get the headlights of the truck, you know, with that blue sky of, you know, just before the sun clips over the top. And we came up, and the buffalo, the males were in rut or whatever you call it. So they said, you know, don't step off the truck. They're pretty wound up, and they're not an animal you want to mess with. You know, they try to raise them really in a way that they're still wild, you know, unlike cattle, but, 1500 head of buffalo surrounded us in the rolling grasslands. And we were near Buffalo, South Dakota. And it's one of those rare places in the United States where you get out and you can't see anything, no telephone poles, nothing that shows that this land is any different than it was 1,000 years ago. And that's the feeling that I got when these buffalo started surrounding us, was it was like stepping back in time, you know, to a time where buffalo migrated from Canada down into Mexico and in these giant herds. And I think, you know, having my son there is, you know, and seeing it through his eyes, I don't know if it'll be tough to really ever top that, you know. And I'll share that piece with you. But it's one of my favorite videos just because of that. It's just so beautiful.
Fantastic. I think you won the podcast today.
I think so. Joe, those memories, and especially that you get to share them with your son.
Yeah.
You've just have been able, and the gorilla too, like that story, I remember you telling me, and still is so profound every time you tell me those experience where your career is taking you, you've seen things that many people won't ever see in their life.
Yeah.
And that's just so cool.
Yeah. You, the access that we get, is, you know, I mean, as a hunter, you always hope to get to these areas where, you know, it's managed properly and it's the perfect conditions to have the biggest bucks and the most animals. And it's tough for most people to ever have access to that. And, you know, we do that 8 months out of the year when we're doing our farm and ranch stories. We are getting out to the places that are managed so well, and the result, you know, they're doing, obviously they have to make a living. So they're mostly running cattle or buffalo, but, you know, it also results in just this amazing wildlife population from, you know, mule deer and elk and, whitetail, but to birds, birds is a big thing. You know, the one thing I noticed when I started doing this was, you know, at first I got into organic farm stories, and I'd been around a lot of conventional farms, and the chemicals used on these conventional farms are, they're taking care of the bugs, which makes the birds go away. And, you know, there's a lot of, adverse effects to what they're doing to these pieces of land. So you get onto an organic farm or a regenerative farm, and you start to see this wildlife again, you know, from what's beneath the surface, you know, the microbial activity below the surface, which is feeding everything above the surface, and, you know, not tilling and leaving cover crops and leaving life in the soil, which allows for nesting. So you have the birds, you know, the prairie chicken and the sharp tail and the pheasants, and then you have the deer coming in and feeding, and, you know, just it is. I will never, ever take what I do for granted because of the access that we have. And I will never not be amazed by a sunrise in these places. You know, it's, I consider myself really lucky.
So speaking about access, I got to think that, you know, most people want to tell their story, right?
Yeah.
And yeah. So, or to share what's special to them. And so, you know, kind of what you're talking about is if someone were to have that type of resource, like the ranch with the buffalo or whatever it is, to know of you or to know you personally, people want to invite you to say, yeah, come capture my thing, because that's my story and I want to share it with people, right? I'm sure you find that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's I don't think people always realize upfront what it means to have that story captured. But after the fact, I think they realize it, you know, this is not, we might go there with the purpose of showing, you know, what a certain mix of grasses is mm-hmm. doing for the environment. But end of the day, you need to understand the why for these farmers and ranchers. Why are they doing this? And it's obviously, again, it's, you know, they have to make a living, but there's more to it. You know, they know they're stewards of the land. They know that they're, you know, it's cliche to say we want to leave it better than we found it, but these people truly do, you know. And when we get these stories together, I want to make sure we're showing the why. Like, what is it with these families? What is it with these people that makes them different? That makes them willing to, you know, maybe spend 3 or 4 years actually losing money to transition their land to something that is better than it was when it was farmed conventionally. And so you get those stories together, and then I remind them as we're doing them, I'm like, you know, think about 2 generations from now, 3 generations, you know, think about your grandkids being able to see these stories and hear your voice and hear you talking about what you've done and why, you know, and then get the family in it. And it's a pretty, you know, it's a pretty cool thing for people to be a part of, I think, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's priceless.
Yeah. And when you say access from a hunting standpoint, you know, when you go and do these stories, it's funny, in one day, it's like these people become family. I mean, Brittany, we've been out, I don't know, just a couple of times, but I feel like you're family to me. I feel like you're one of my kids. You know, I love watching your life through social media and through talking and seeing you do well. And, you know, I sort of fall in love with every family that I work with. And so your family, and they're like, come on back and hunt, you know, and, you know, so that the access that we have, you know, to go back and I'm trying to really force myself to take more time and do that, you know, mm-hmm. take a trip, you know, go out and whether it's do some sharptail hunting in Montana with somebody that I met or whatever it is, to go back to these places and experience them without the camera. Although I don't know, I probably would still have a camera with me, you know.
Let's face it, you would
for sure. Yeah, yeah.
That's a must.
Yep.
I've seen you, Joe, on 2 of these hunts now, like I know from experience, but I've also heard you talk about some of your other hunts, and I gotta imagine the physical demands of doing this type of job is extreme. I am always humbled by every camera guy, gal I run into, because it's not just carrying this like dainty little camera with you know, an extra lens. It's, you're packing a ton of gear and it's heavy. So yes. What does that look like? How do you prepare for it? How do you train to do what you do?
Yeah. Well, I started doing CrossFit 7 years ago. I had torn my bicep off and had it reattached. And I was, I think I was 50 years old, and I just looked at myself in the mirror and I'm like, all right, you got a choice right now. I've always enjoyed being active. And I just decided that I wasn't ready to be old. So I got into CrossFit, and I've gotten into it. Like, you know, first rule of CrossFit is always talk about CrossFit, right? But I've gotten into it probably over the top, but it's sort of my escape every day. And more than anything, like, one thing I've realized with these hunts is I need to be in better shape than the people that I'm hunting with. And, you know, when you're hunting with Austin and Garrett Nimmo in Wyoming, or Andrew and Iris McKean in Montana, I mean, these people are goats. This is where they live, and they train for this, and they run these mountains like all year round. And that's what you're up against. You know, I'm mid 50s and these guys are in their 20s, and I need to keep up. I've always told myself, if there is a day where I'm holding back the people that I'm hunting with, that I'm done. And I'm really serious about it. Like, I don't want to change anything they do with their hunt. I don't ever want anyone waiting up for me, which is funny, because at first I think they see me and they're like, all right, this is an old dude. He looks like he's in decent shape, but he's an old dude. Is he going to be able to keep up? I can always tell them they're sizing me up. Right. And I think, you know, so I catch them at first looking back, and I have 50 or 60 pounds on my back, and I'm always trying to figure out ways to downsize, but still be able to run the cameras and have the, you know, capture the best quality image. Cause I think, you know, you see a lot of hunting shows where they've just decided that they're going to have that one camera that has a zoom lens, and, you know, it's not going to have that cinematic look, but it's going to be good enough. Right. And they're bouncing around and they're hand holding and all that. I'm like, no, I want this to be the best piece of film that I can create, despite the fact that I have to carry this thing through a river and up a mountain, right? So I really have to work hard at it, you know? I mean, we were running snowshoes, and we thought we were, you know, a couple of weeks ago in Idaho, we thought we were overnight camping, and it was like below zero. And, you know, so you have to have the right gear. Thankfully, I've gotten on the pro guide with Sitka, so I can get gear for half price, which is kind of dangerous, because you're like, oh, it's only half price. Next thing you know, your closet's full of all this gear, which is great, but it does get expensive. But you have to have the right gear, and, you know, I'm running snowshoes, and yeah, you gotta be ready to get after it in any condition, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I would definitely say you are a good, role model for a lot of folks to just like stop living a stagnant life and get out there and get in shape so you can enjoy things long-term. Right. I think that's safe for all of us. I think we all can get our butts back in the shape a little better. I remember after Reagan shot that deer, you're just like, yeah, I'll drag this thing out. And you drug it over like five tree trunks, like down through a creek, up the hill. I was like, okay, I'll just stand back here.
It was pretty jacked up.
It was fantastic.
Yeah.
I loved it. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah.
Rav, you got any follow-ups on that, or should we move into our very intense lightning round?
Let's do some lightning round. I'm excited to hear what Joe's got to got some answers for some fun questions.
Yeah. So, Joe, these are just like black and white questions, right? This or that. If you want to explain, you sure can, but you don't have to. And I think I was scribbling these down earlier, and I was bouncing back between like photography questions and filming, but I think I'm just going to go with filming. So strictly filming hat, right?
Yeah.
What's your preference, game birds or big game?
Oh, man. See, this is tough. Are you talking filming or doing the hunt?
filming all of this.
Big game.
Okay. That was quick. I kind of expected you to say waterfowl.
You know what? I'm a waterfowl and bird dog hunter. So if you were talking hunting, if that was the question, I would have said birds.
So there's part two of it. Maybe I need to ask both these questions both ways. Okay. So if you're filming, would you prefer to film somebody archery hunting or firearm hunting?
Oh, firearm.
Okay. Okay. So here's the follow-up to that. With the firearm, do you prefer a shotgun or rifle?
Rifle. And again, I'm answering these questions with the filmmaker cap on.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming the reason I had to pause, because if you were like, if you're hunting, would it be bow or gun? And I would have said bow.
This is funny. So you would prefer to film everything opposite of, or do everything opposite of what you said you wanted to film.
Yes. I like big space. A rifle gets you into big space.
True.
Yeah.
True. Okay. Okay. All right. So would you rather film in a mountainous setting or more of a plain setting?
Mountain.
Yeah, I feel like that was a taker. I also feel like I should have mentioned Africa because that was going to be on the list, I imagine.
No, it would have been. It's still mountain. I think mountain in the United States. Yeah.
Okay. So are you liking a lodge style film setup, or would you prefer like a backcountry or intense running and gunning type of setting?
Backcountry.
It's because you're so in shape. That's why, huh?
Yeah. Talk to me in a few years. You're like Super 8 in the Super 8. Let's film in the Super 8. Yeah.
That has heat.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So would you rather film youth or would you rather film adults?
Youth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Shag go youth programs.
Yep.
Okay. So this is another one follow up here. So would you rather be in a blind or a stand filming, or would you rather be like on a spot and stock where you're moving and shaking the whole time?
Spot and stock.
Yeah.
I get too fidgety in a blind.
And that's what you did.
You've seen it.
Yeah. Well, same. I'm like a Energizer bunny for me being blind. It takes a special kind of willpower for me to dial it in. Okay. So would you rather film German Shorthair pointers or labs working?
German Shorthair pointers. Come on.
Oh, you're killing me, Joe.
And you would rather run or own what breed of the two?
You know, I have a 10-year-old lab upstairs and a 1-year-old German Shorthair, and I think they're both listening. So I'm going to say both.
Yeah,
you're a good dog, Dad.
You know what? It's like asking which kid is your favorite.
That's right. Yeah.
You can't say that.
Yeah, don't offend them by any means.
You got to have more than one tool in the toolbox, right, Rob?
That's right.
I love it. Okay, so this is the ninth question. I had like an 8.5 written down here because I had to chuckle at myself when I was thinking of it. So since you're a CrossFit guru, I literally Googled CrossFit terms. Do you prefer a Turkish get up or a muscle up?
Oh, man, muscle up all day.
All right. I love it.
I think that's the first time we've had a different language in our lightning round.
Yes.
Very much so. I imagine everybody's going to be looking up Turkish get up now.
Yeah, we'll let them. That's fun.
That is a tough move.
What isn't that where you're like on your back with a dumbbell, right?
Yeah, you get one arm in the air and one leg up, and then you have to get yourself up on your side and somehow stand up and then get yourself back down. And I would imagine that move comes in handy if I ever like fell with all my gear on and I have to keep my camera out of the water. It is a useful move, I'm sure.
It's just a pain to learn and want to do.
It is. It's not fun. There's nothing fun about a Turkish get up.
Yeah, you should have seen me earlier, Joe. I was like, wad and Turkish get up and muscle up and handstand press. It's like, okay, I don't know what I'm talking about.
I'm impressed. Those are two very good ones.
Thank you. Oh, man. Well, Joe, thanks so much for joining us. I feel like we could probably sit here and talk for hours and hours and hours. And I think maybe we'll have to have a 2.0 conversation with all of us talking about our dogs one day.
Yes, I'm in.
Sweet. Yeah, Joe, you know, we always try and close and encourage our listeners to support the Great Plains Outdoors podcast, but to support conservation on the Great Plains for sure, and to try and join any of those organizations that help do that, whether it's Pheasants Forever, Ducks Unlimited, Delta Waterfowl, National Wild Turkey Federation, Rocky Mountain Elk Federation, Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. Is there one of those that maybe you're passionate about?
Oh man, you were, well, I love what you guys are doing with the mentoring, you know. So I think, you know, the outdoor mentors, you know, I think youth hunting, if we don't get kids back into this sport or this lifestyle, it's going to not only affect hunting, but it's going to affect conservation. So any organization that's working with youth.
Yeah, I echo that too. It's super important. We actively engage that population and give them a chance to learn if they love it and learn what they love about it, so they can be long-term license purchasers and recreation goers.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Joe, how do people find you and your photography film work online? Instagram, Facebook, social media of any sort? What do you have?
Yeah, I would say Instagram is probably the best place to see, you know, a mix of my work, and that would be Joe Dickey, JoeDickie. My website is, I've always been guilty of really not putting any time into a website. So if you go to joedickeyphotography.com, that's my website. And you get to the opening pages, it's like, that's pretty good. And then you get into the back pages, and it's like, it hasn't been updated since 2008. So I'm super guilty of not taking care of my marketing side of things, which I guess is a positive. I just haven't needed to. Everything's been word of mouth, but one day I will update that site. But anyway, that's best places to find me.
There you go. And be prepared to see Cash, his German Shorthair pointer, in action on his Instagram.
Yeah, he's so been sort of your heart. Yeah.
Awesome.
Well, Joe, thanks so much for joining us. Everyone, thanks for listening in to our Great Plains Outdoors podcast. Please share it with a friend, and we'll see you next time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks, Joe. See you, Rob.